From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how George W. Bush tamed his inner scamp. We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicholas Kristof about his series of biographical articles on Bush in the New York Times. Also, satirist Harry Shearer gives us his take on the Republican National Convention. He's in Philadelphia for the Alternative Shadow Convention, where he's part of a rapid response team critiquing each night's events. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Doctors in Philadelphia say former President Gerald Ford suffered two small strokes at yesterday's session of the Republican National Convention. The 87-year-old Ford was hospitalized with slurred speech, dizziness, and weakness in his arm. One doctor said the former president's thinking is good and his chances for a full recovery are fine. Ford first went to the hospital after complaining of balance problems during a tribute in his honor last night. Doctors first diagnosed the problem as a sinus infection and sent him back to his hotel with antibiotics. The strokes were discovered by an imaging scan on his second visit to the hospital. Republican vice presidential hopeful Dick Cheney gets his moment in the primetime spotlight tonight at the GOP convention. Delegates look for him to stand up for his conservative politics and to take a few jabs at Vice President Al Gore. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Traditionally, vice presidents have served as the attack dogs at conventions, leaving the presidential nominee free to sound more positive themes. But while Cheney can be a partisan conservative at times, delegates aren't expecting much in the way of fireworks tonight from the mild-mannered former Secretary of Defense. For the Wyoming delegation, tonight is the highlight of the convention. Don Mikey says he's known Cheney since he was an assistant in Gerald Ford's White House. He says he still can't get over his friend's return to prominence.
So it's been a wonderful experience for me. I cried when Dick was nominated, and I'm still crying a little bit about it. It's so great.
Aides to Cheney expect him to talk about his quarter century of experience in Washington and his decision to run one more time. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Philadelphia.
In 10 western states, fire crews are shorthanded during the worst fire season in 12 years. Only 50 people are battling a blaze in western Wyoming that has forced evacuations. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Alpern reports.
200 residents and campers have been evacuated from the path of a fire in the Jackson Hole area. What is known as the Boulder Creek Fire grew from 700 acres Monday to over 1,800 acres the next day. Forest Service spokeswoman Mary Tyler says their work has been made even more difficult because of the conditions throughout the western half of the country.
We have had a hard time getting resources to fight the fire because there are so many thousands of acres burning in Idaho and the rest of the west.
Tyler says firefighters from North Carolina are on their way to help. Meanwhile, the shorthanded crew continues to try and protect the 35 homes that are in the fire's path. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Alpern in Laramie, Wyoming.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 81 points to end the day at 10,688 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 27 points, or 0.7%. It closed at 3,658. This is NPR News. The Navy is planning a new round of training exercises on Puerto Rico's Vieques Island. Naval officials posted a notice in Puerto Rican newspapers warning that bombing practice could begin as early as tomorrow. The Navy's bombing range on the island has been a target for protests since last year, when a stray bomb killed a civilian security guard on the range. The Navy will be operating under an agreement between President Clinton and Puerto Rico's governor that allows only non-explosive bombs to be used on the range. Track and Field's international governing body has reduced the drug suspension for Cuban high jump champion Javier Sotomayor. The 1992 Olympic gold medalist will now be able to compete in next month's Summer Olympics in Sydney. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
32-year-old Javier Sotomayor was stripped of his gold medal at last year's Pan American Games after testing positive for cocaine. Sotomayor insisted he was innocent, but track and field's governing body, the IAAF, suspended him until next year, meaning he'd miss what probably would be his final Olympics. Today, however, the IAAF cited its exceptional circumstances rule in cutting the suspension in half, meaning it now has expired. An IAAF spokesman says the decision was based in part on Sotomayor having a distinguished career that was, until last year, drug-free. The IAAF still believes Sotomayor took cocaine. Asked whether today's decision meant the Federation was softening its position on drugs, the spokesman said the IAAF is committed to punishing drug cheats, but sometimes being human isn't so bad. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
The S&P 500 gained a half point to close at 1,438. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Political conventions present carefully packaged versions of candidates. My guest Nicholas Kristof has been researching the life of George W. Bush for an ongoing series of biographical articles in the New York Times. Kristof has served as the Times bureau chief in Beijing and Tokyo. He and his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, shared a 1990 Pulitzer Prize for their reporting from Tiananmen Square. We invited Kristof to talk about the Bush pieces that have already been published, which cover his life until the age of 40, the year he gave up drinking and, as Kristof puts it, tamed his inner scamp. One of Kristof's articles was titled The Cheerleader. In 1963, George W. Bush was head cheerleader at Phillips Academy, the prep school in Andover, Massachusetts. I asked Kristof what he thinks is significant about that.
I think that one of the most remarkable things about George W. Bush is his incredible people skills. I think that it was really at Andover, a long way from home in this cold place that initially he felt pretty lonesome at, that he really cultivated those people skills and that you could first see them. And I think it was really tough for him because he went to a place that his father had been. His father had been a great athlete and a great student. And George W. was pretty lousy in both the classroom and the athletic field. But where he really stood out was in those people skills and cheering people up. And that was best seen, perhaps, as in his role as head cheerleader.
And you say at a time when a lot of students were having encounters with police because they were demonstrating against the war or for the civil rights movement, that George W. Bush had a couple of encounters with police, but they were for a completely different reason. What were those encounters about?
Yeah, he was pursuing not so much grand principles as more having a good time. His first encounter was in his junior year when he was president of his fraternity. Christmas was coming up. He wanted to decorate the fraternity, and the way he did that was he and a few friends went downtown in New Haven. They apparently had a few drinks, and they stole a wreath one night from a local hotel. It was a lousy crime. The police car was coming down the road, promptly arrested them, and the charges were later dropped. Then the following year, during a football game with Princeton, it was a very exciting game, and he and a bunch of other students charged down in the field to dismantle the Princeton goalposts. And when the campus police rushed down, there he was right on top of the crossbars, and he was arrested again.
Several of your articles were about Bush's very early years, his childhood, his high school years, his college years. A later article was titled How Bush Came to Tame His Inner Scamp. And it kind of picks up on this kind of like fun-loving, mischievous George Bush of the high school and college years and how that carried over to his early business career and even his early political career as well. How did that, inner scamp, as you put it, get expressed during his early professional life?
I think it was a real problem for him that there were a lot of people who were kind of wild in college, and then they married and settled down and got into business. And he had a lot of trouble settling down. He calls those years in his 20s the nomadic years, and he tried a few jobs and really didn't make a great success of them. And in a family where expectations were enormous, his dad at that point had been a war hero, had been became a millionaire very young, was Phi Beta Kappa from Yale. George W. was kind of wandering around, not really doing an awful lot. And he he was kind of the wild man of the Bush clan, sometimes the bit of the black sheep. And he was very, very funny, and people liked to be around him. But especially after he'd had a few drinks, he could turn people off by coming across as arrogant. He could speak a little bit too bluntly. He could make fun of people. I think especially after he moved to Texas, it was a somewhat more socially conservative environment. And when he started making jokes and teasing people, a lot of people just thought, you know, who is this cocky little kid who comes in and just laughs at everybody? And they perceived him as quite arrogant. I think he gradually calmed down after that.
How much drinking did he do in those younger days? And did it ever get to the point where it was interfering with his work or interfering with his family life?
I don't think that he wasn't a regular drunk. It wasn't as if he was regularly going out singing on the sidewalks. He himself says he doesn't really know whether he was an alcoholic, and I think that's probably a fair assessment. He was clearly drinking too much. He was drinking essentially every day, but mostly a lot of beers as opposed to really hard stuff. And it was usually drinking with his buddies. People who were around him thought that it interfered maybe with his work, but only at the margin, that he would mostly drink in the evening, and he would get a buzz rather than really get drunk. I think it did interfere with his family life. You get a lot of different stories about that, and his family and friends are quite protective about it, but it does seem that he just came home a few too many times, a little bit sloshed, embarrassing his wife in front of other people, not setting a good example for his daughters. And this became a growing source of tension between him and Laura.
Do you know how he stopped drinking?
It was really quite remarkable. He's a very impetuous guy, does a lot of things at the on the spur of the moment. Back when he was 20 years old, he got engaged with another woman on kind of the spur of the moment. And sure enough, when he decided that this was kind of getting in the way and interfering with his marriage, he very abruptly decided on the morning after his 40th birthday party with a bunch of friends that he just wasn't feeling great. And he loved to jog, and it was getting in the way of his jogging. And he just decided, okay, I'm going to stop drinking. And he didn't tell anybody. It was a few weeks before he told even his wife and his best buddies. They just noticed that all of a sudden he wasn't drinking beer, he was drinking sodas. And they asked him, and he kept it up. And as far as we know, he's never touched alcohol since.
Now, you also mentioned a meeting that George W.'s parents set up between George W. and Billy Graham. And the meeting was at Kennebunkport, the family's summer home. What was that meeting about, and what happened there, to your knowledge?
I think his parents were genuinely concerned about George W. They wanted him to settle down a little bit more. They were very happy when he got married, when he threw himself more into work. And then he still wasn't entirely getting it. And then in 1985, in their effort to kind of calm him down a little bit, sober him up, they did introduce him and the other children to Billy Graham. They had a lot of conversations there. And there was no sudden, you know, road to Damascus kind of event, but it clearly got him thinking a little bit more. He had gone to church regularly before that, but apparently less out of any kind of deep personal commitment and more because he wanted his daughters to grow up going to church. And after that, when he returned to Midland, he started reading the Bible regularly. He joined a Bible study group. And I think it was a sort of a steady process in which he began to settle down in a lot of ways and become closer to the church as well.
Do you know how much of a role religion plays in his life now on how he identifies spiritually?
I think that it plays a pretty important role. He says that he still reads the Bible every day. I don't think that he uses it as a litmus test in terms of issues so much, but I think that as a source of comfort, as a way of steadying himself in terms of the kind of life that he wants to lead, I think that it does play a quite important role. He's a little bit sensitive about it because he's closer, a little bit closer to the evangelical end of the church, and I think he's sensitive to the notion that a lot of Americans not make fun of, but have doubts about that wing of the church. And he's, when you press him on evolution, for example, he doesn't want to talk about his beliefs, and he doesn't give a very clear answer about it. He got in trouble at one point when he was governor of Texas because he told the story of when he was visiting the White House, and he and Barbara got into a discussion about whether only Christians could go to heaven. And he said that, yes, that only, you know, he said, the Bible says only people who have accepted Christ as their Savior are going to get to heaven. And Barbara said, no, I don't think that's, you know, I can't believe that. And so they called Billy Graham and got his, the White House switchboard got him, and he resolved this. And his view was, well, George W.'s reading of the Bible is more or less the same of mine, but look, you guys don't play God. And, you know, it's not up to you guys to determine who gets into heaven. And there was a, obviously, when that story got out, there was a lot of sensitivity to it, a lot of reaction to it. And he was, I think, affronted by this notion that he was sort of telling Jews, for example, no place for you in heaven. And he, that incident and a few others, I think, left him feeling very, very uncomfortable talking about his inner beliefs.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nicholas Kristof, and he's a national correspondent for The New York Times. He's been writing a series of biographical articles about George W. Bush. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicholas Kristof. He's the former Tokyo and Beijing bureau chief of The New York Times. He's now a national correspondent, and he's been writing a series of biographical articles about George W. Bush. Now, you did some research into George Bush's drinking before he stopped drinking at the age of 40. There had been some question earlier in the primary campaign about whether he had ever done drugs, recreational drugs, as they're called.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you decided to investigate that yourself, if you thought it was worthy of investigation, and how you approached that question.
I looked at it a little bit. And one of the issues for us as journalists, of course, is to what degree does somebody's private life, does mistakes they made a long time ago matter today? I think that it is fair to do this kind of a biographical series about a candidate and look at all aspects of his early life to get a better understanding. And I think that if they broke the law of various kinds, and that does matter. And so I did, from that point of view, look at it. My sense was that this perception that kind of fuels late-night comedy shows that he, you know, was drugged throughout the 1970s and doesn't really remember them is really totally wrong. He virtually admits having used drugs. He comes so close in his comments to having used, to acknowledging having used illegal drugs before 1974 that most of his friends think that, well, he must have used them at some point. I mean, that he, since he basically admits it, he must have, you know, he probably at some point or maybe a few times at a party used things, but there's no particular evidence of that. And what is clearer is that there's no, you know, there's no pattern of him as a druggie by any means.
How much did George W.'s father help him through his career? You know, help him get into the good schools, the private high school, Yale, the National Guard during the Vietnam War.
I think a great deal. On left and right, there are two basic misconceptions about George W. I think that liberals don't give him credit for being as smart as he is. I think he's smarter than people think. And on the right among his backers. I think that people exaggerate the degree to which he did things himself. He almost certainly would not have gotten into Andover High School if it had not been for his dad having been there and having been a stellar student there. Then when he applied to Yale, he again almost certainly would not have gotten to Yale given his grades and his college boards. They were way below what was expected of Yale. And so he would not have gotten into, you know, Andover and Yale. He had been turned down by a private high school in Houston that was much less exclusive than Andover. Later, he was turned down by the University of Texas Law School. So you get the sense that where he did not have that sort of affirmative action based on his parentage, that he would not have gotten into these great schools. Later on, he had a lot of advantage because of the name when he was first running for in politics, both in 1978 when he lost, later when he ran for governor. It certainly helped that this name was known, that he had funding, that he had his dad's Rolodex. It's hard to imagine that he would have been part owner of a baseball team under very advantageous conditions if it had not been for his family and his connections. So I think that his dad tremendously helped. I mean, having said that, I think he has a lot of very good business skills. I think it's easy to imagine him having been a success in business.
One of the things I feel like I really don't understand about George W. Bush is why he went into politics in the first place. Now, granted, his father, his grandfather were both in politics. But, you know, George W. in his early years seems pretty uninterested in politics, pretty uninvolved in the major political issues of his day. He starts off in business and then gets into politics in around 1978.
I think that people I think people go into politics for different reasons, and I think some go into it because they have some kind of bedrock political beliefs or because they're fueled by outrage about something. And I don't think that is true whatsoever of George W. Bush. I think that he went into politics for two reasons. One is that he's always liked the limelight. He's always been great on the stage. He's liked being in the spotlight. And as a kid in high school or when he was in college, the way to do that was to have great parties or be the head cheerleader, for example. And when you're a grown-up, one of the ways of doing that is to go into politics. And I think he really relishes the limelight and enjoys it and is very, very good at it. Secondly, I think that there is this legacy in the Bush family of noblesse oblige, this idea of going into public service. It's something that has been drummed into them since they were small kids. And when George W. was a small boy, his grandfather, Prescott Bush, was a senator. And there were all kinds of family legends about, you know, the idea of serving the people and doing good. And I think that's probably also a part of it. But it's not because he was particularly interested in issues or had some firm ideology, because I don't think he does or did.
In doing this series on George W. Bush's biography, what do you feel you've been able to learn about his core beliefs and the beliefs that motivate him, that are most central to his personal and political life?
I think he's remarkably non-ideological, remarkably flexible. I think that the things that really matter to him are his friendships. He invests enormous time in cultivating these friendships and keeping them, you know, much, much more time than in reading books or figuring out where he thinks. You don't get a sense that he has a strong political philosophy, that he's thought out a lot of issues in great depth, or even particularly bothered to stay informed on a lot of issues. He knows baseball trivia just up and down, and he's got a great mind for that. I mean, clearly if he wanted to, he could memorize the names of foreign leaders, but it's just, I think, not something that he's particularly fascinated by.
You mentioned that because he was quizzed about the name of, was it the president or prime minister of India, and he got it wrong.
A number of foreign leaders, right. Yeah. And then he got them all wrong. And it comes up periodically that he just doesn't know a lot of the things that kind of that people expect a presidential candidate to know about. I'm not sure how much that hurts him with voters. I think that's an open question. But he's somebody who, even on the road, he periodically, I mean, he talks about issues, but he sometimes says something along the lines that, you know, what's most important is to lift the spirits of America. And I think that that is something that he feels is important. And it's kind of a non-ideological, you know, more of a, in a sense, aspiring to be head of state rather than head of government or something. But you get the sense that he, you know, that he certainly has general beliefs, and I think a skepticism about the role of government in a lot of things is an element of that. But that it's not, these issues are things that are not a huge, not something that he's passionate about.
So if he's reasonably disengaged and somewhat uninformed about the actual issues nationally and internationally, then who do you think is calling the shots now and leading the party?
You know, it's interesting writing as a journalist about a presidential candidate, because I really try desperately hard to be absolutely neutral and so on. And so let me say that I think that his supporters don't adequately acknowledge the degree to which he is uninformed. And people complain about that pop quiz, for example, but I think there really is something to that, that he is remarkably uninformed about geopolitics. And it's not just that he's been a governor rather than in the federal government, but that this is not – he's not the guy who – not the kind of guy who goes home and reads a book about policy, about the world, who thinks about these grand issues a lot. On the other hand, though, in his favor, I think one can say, and I think his critics don't do him justice in this respect, that he surrounds himself or he attracts some very smart policy advisors. And his economic team, his foreign policy team, these are smart, first-rate people. And he doesn't seem intimidated or insecure by the idea of having first-rate minds around him. Gore clearly knows the issues, I think, much, much better. But I think one can make the case that Bush has attracted policy advisors who, in terms of competence within the field, are at least as good.
Nicholas Kristof is a national correspondent for The New York Times. He's writing a series of biographical articles about George W. Bush. Kristof will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, satirist Harry Shearer gives us his take on the Republican National Convention, and we continue our discussion about the formative years of George W. Bush with Nicholas Kristof of The New York Times.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicholas Kristof. He's writing an ongoing series of biographical articles about George W. Bush for the New York Times. We invited him to talk about the already published pieces, which follow Bush to the age of 40. Kristof is a national correspondent for the Times and is the paper's former bureau chief in Beijing and Tokyo. He's in Philadelphia for the Republican National Convention. Laura Bush spoke, George W.'s wife, spoke the opening night of the convention and, you know, talked about her husband, talked about the importance of reading and literacy and education in her life. She's a former teacher and school librarian. Anything you want to share about her professional life that might reflect on her future as a first lady if her husband is elected?
I think he's very, very lucky personally and in terms of his career that he found her and married her. She is very much the opposite of him in just about every way. And if he had married somebody who was similar to him, I mean, he would have just really gone off the top, I think. While she has reined him in, pulled him back, grounded him much better. And she comes across, you know, as this very meek and mild person who one could, I think, misperceive as sort of a doormat. And I don't think that's true at all. I think that she, in private, can be very tough with him. I think that he genuinely worried when he was going through his wilder times that she might leave him and take the girls with him. And he adores those daughters. And I think she really changed him tremendously in his personality and got him to calm down. One of his buddies told me that in those wilder years that he never kind of had a filter between his brain and his mouth, and that if he thought something, he would just spew it out. And that made him outrageously funny, but also just outrageously obnoxious at times. And Laura kind of put a filter in there. And I think that she is one major reason why he is indeed now coming to Philadelphia as the Republican nominee.
In one of your pieces about George W. Bush, you mentioned that he reads, I don't know, like three or four newspapers a day, a couple of the Texas papers, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. And the New York Times is your paper. Have you found him any more or less willing to speak with you directly? Because he reads the New York Times, and he probably reads your articles about him in the Times.
On the one hand, he and his campaign clearly think that the New York Times is an important paper, and that helps with access. On the other hand, there is this feeling among him and the people around him who are Texans and in many cases West Texans that these liberal Northeastern establishment people look down on us. They think we're dumb. They don't give us credit. They just want to make fun of us. And there's a feeling of unfairness there. And George W., I think, has he has a certain skepticism about journalists and the whole Bush family does. And I think that part of that is because there's no aspect of that he thinks is more important than loyalty. His whole family, you know, has emphasized loyalty so much. And what journalists are, in a sense, is disloyal. In other words, we're, you know, there we are on the campaign plane or interviewing people, and we're friendly and we joke. And then when something happens, we write a tough story. And there's a real fundamental tension there between how we see our roles and how he and the people around him see their roles. And also they're used to, I think, the way the Texas press has covered the governor, and we are much more aggressive. So I must say, you know, for all the talk about his charm, and he can just charm your socks off when he wants to, he, in the interview that I did principally about his background, he was not charming at all. He was pretty disgruntled. He was he's very uncomfortable with having people look, you know, through this past.
Can you give me an example from your encounters with George W. Bush of him at his most charming and him at his most disgruntled?
He's very, very good at asking what you think about something or asking advice. And, of course, everybody, and reporters included, are just, you know, they think the smartest people in the world are those who ask them questions. And he's very good at that. He's very good at jokes because I'd been in China before, so he, you know, he wanted to chat about China informally and casually, and he comes across as in those kinds of situations as eminently likable and funny. On the other hand, when I talked to him, for example, I was pressing him about the degree to which he had followed his dad every step of the way in his early years, that, you know, he went to the same schools, that like his dad, he'd gotten engaged initially at age 20, then he became a pilot, went to Midland to get into the oil business, and, you know, whether there was some pattern there. And he just freezes over, and just the room becomes icy, and he becomes very dismissive. He's one of the least contemplative people I know. I think he's smart, but he's not, he doesn't philosophize. He doesn't hold up, you know, an idea to the light and turn it around and think about it. And I had a sort of funny conversation with him in which I said that it's difficult because in writing this kind of a biography, what I'm looking for is a way to round out a subject, to understand somebody better. And to do that, you look for things like inner conflict or inner debate or some kind of uncertainty, this kind of thing. And that I found him remarkably short of that kind of inner conflict. And I sort of was asking him for any advice about where to look. And it was interesting because that was one of the few times when he was a little bit more reflective. And he said, he acknowledged that he's not particularly contemplated, that he's uncomfortable with what he calls psychobabble. And he sort of cocked his head and thought, well, you know, I wonder if that's a bad thing or a good thing. But it does make it hard to do this kind of biography, to make it more than just stringing together a bit of facts, but to find these patterns when the subject that you're writing about doesn't himself want to examine himself in that way and doesn't want to connect dots.
Nicholas Kristof, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nicholas Kristof is a national correspondent for The New York Times. He's writing a series of ongoing articles about the life of George W. Bush. Coming up, satirist Harry Shearer on the Republican National Convention. This is Fresh Air. Satirist Harry Shearer is in Philadelphia to participate in the Shadow Convention, which is presenting discussions on issues likely to be glossed over at the Republican and Democratic conventions. Shearer is the moderator of the Shadow Convention's Rapid Response Team, a panel of satirists, journalists, and pundits. Last night, in front of an audience at a Philadelphia theater, they watched a broadcast of the Republican National Convention while supplying a play-by-play analysis of it. Harry Shearer is also an actor and does the voices of several characters on The Simpsons. His program, Le Show, is heard on public radio stations around the country. What's been your reaction to the diversity theme throughout the week at the convention?
Nice try. Nice try. You know, this is, we call what we're doing is the Shadow Convention, but what the Republicans are putting on is the real Shadow Convention because it has a very little resemblance to the actual party. The actual party is what's going on away from the cameras, the Tom DeLay hospitality car, liquor swilling, cigar smoking, lobbyist entertaining, real convention. And what they're putting on television is a real shadow of that.
What did you think when Jim Colby of Arizona, who's the only openly gay a member of Congress who's a Republican, spoke about trade, not homosexuality, but about trade, and several members of the Texas delegation took their hats off and bowed their heads in prayer in opposition to homosexuality.
Well, I'd say that's a remarkably brief, honest moment breaking out in a convention where the honesty has been rigorously policed.
J.C. Watts as Republican conference chair.
Mm-hmm.
Any reaction?
You know, they're trying hard. And I don't want to be, because I will be out of the country when the Democrats are on, I don't want to be mistaken as deriding the Republicans and giving the Democrats some slack, because the Democratic convention, unless I'm seriously mistaken, will be equally mendacious and equally puffy and equally without substance and equally without an accurate representation of what's really going on. Both parties, I believe, have decided that what the American public really doesn't like is politics, and they are dedicated to giving us politics-free political conventions. The American public responds by watching these things in fewer and fewer numbers and voting in fewer and fewer numbers. So there seems to be a referendum going on politics-free politics, and the politicians seem to be either losing or, depending on what you think their real goal is, winning.
George W. Bush has been putting across this compassionate conservative message, and I wonder why you think that that's the image now that George W. Bush wants to put forward, and how that's going over
one
the
word,
American public.
One word: women. They've decided that the battleground for this election is women, and that women didn't like the Pat Buchanan, Pat Robertson image of the Republican Party. And so they reconfigured the image of the party to be gal-pleasing. It's like, to use a word common in daytime television, a makeover.
W is for women.
Yeah, W stands for women, a wonderfully triple entendre slogan. It may mean he stands up when they come into the room. It may mean he puts up with them. It may mean that he advocates their issues. Who knows?
Have you noticed that none of the senators or congressmen who were really big during the impeachment proceedings are being featured at the podium?
I put out a call the other night on MSNBC for them to find the managers. Find the House managers, please. Would you please? Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. The actual Republican Party has been removed from this program. Trent Lott was relegated to a noontime speech. You know, Trent Lott is arguably the most powerful Republican currently in office. You can at least make a case for that. In any previous political convention, by virtue of his office, he would have been accorded a prime speaking slot. Relegation, his happy relegation, he's totally cheerful about it when asked, his happy relegation to a non-covered slot is emblematic of what they're doing. They're covering up the real Republican Party, a party of white men.
If you're just joining us, my guest is satirist Harry Shearer. Have you heard George W. Bush speak much extemporaneously?
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to more of it. Well, because he has his daddy's talent for cuisinarting the English language in new and refreshing ways. There is a site at slate.com called Bushisms, and it gives you some sense of what we're in store for if he wins, or even if he doesn't. And he has, it's a Bush family gene. They're on nodding acquaintance with the syntax of the English language, but it's an uneasy acquaintance.
As a satirist, you do the voices of a lot of political leaders. How close is George W.'s to George Bush's?
Well, you're hitting a very painful nerve right now, because I did George W. on my last program, and then listening back, I'm saying to myself, the critic in my head is saying, "You're still doing George. You don't have George W. yet." There's a George Pear is a little more of a baritone. George Fee is more of a whiny alto. Also, there's a sibilance thing that the son has that the father doesn't. He's got a SH sound for S's that his dad doesn't quite have. And there's a way that he punches words, George W. punches words, you know. He also doesn't repeat things in the kind of daffy way that his dad did. And George W. will use the first-person personal pronoun, something that you may remember his dad avoided like the plague. Getting up in the morning, looking forward to solving the country's problems, dealing with Saddam Hussein. He was taught by his mom never to use that first-person pronoun, and he never did. George W. doesn't have that problem.
There were a lot of protests around Philadelphia yesterday. And I'm wondering, I think one of them was near your hotel. I don't know whether you were outside for any of it or saw some of it on TV, but were you surprised by any of your own reaction to either the protests or to the police reaction to the protests?
Well, I came, as you said, from Los Angeles, and we're expecting this, if not more so, for our convention. I say our convention, the one that's going to be staged in Los Angeles. I come at it from this point of view. I'm very grateful to Ariana and whoever else conceived of the Shadow Convention for reimagining the theatrics of dissent. I am sick unto death of people trying to recapitulate the mechanics and the theatrics of the 1960s in terms of dissent and protest. You can make an argument that those tactics were chosen then or erupted then or evolved then because the issues then were bodies were really on the line in the Vietnam War, in the freedom rides, in the civil rights struggle of the South. Human bodies were on the line, and so confrontational tactics, I think, were understandable, if not the only conceivable choice. But in this day and age, to tie up rush hour traffic and just tick off hundreds and thousands of motorists to make a point which, you know, I watched the television coverage, the point didn't get across. Whatever they were protesting about was not covered. What was covered was the tactics of the police, the tactics of the protesters. Okay, they're moving up Walnut Street. We think they're moving over to, you know, that's the coverage they get. They got plenty of it, but only one correspondent that I heard in 2 hours of television coverage actually read one banner that was being carried by a protester. So it does not succeed in communicating, which one would think would be the chief goal of protest. And like a lot of strikes in the bad old days, it ticks off the innocent bystanders to no good purpose.
Harry, you've flown out to Philadelphia to participate in the Shadow Convention that's being held here. And the convention, the Democratic Convention, will be coming to your hometown in Los Angeles. Will you be doing anything there?
I will be. My body will be in Edinburgh, Scotland. I'll be appearing at the Edinburgh Festival with the rest of the Simpsons cast.
Oh.
We'll be doing a live performance of the Simpsons in Edinburgh and then two in London. But I'm going to leave behind a little piece that on video that I hope will be part of the Shadow Convention, which is something I did at a one-man show in San Francisco earlier this year. It's a silent debate among the presidential candidates, which I have a lot of videotape of these guys just sitting in front of a television camera not saying anything. I can't tell you how I get it. And there is something that happens to you when you see people who you normally see on television just with their jaws flapping suddenly being quiet but sitting there. And I hope that that's revealing of something to the crowd at the Shadow Convention in L.A.
How's your Al Gore coming?
Oh, my Al Gore is well in shape, of course. I've been doing him for basically the entire length of the Clinton administration. So I don't want to show it off here now. You were sort of suggesting that I do so?
Well, I was going to kind of push hard. But let me ask you
say,
what...
Let me just say, Terry, that I look forward to the proceedings in Los Angeles. I think we're going to make a show of unity and progress and relevance for the 21st century that is sadly lacking in my Republican brethren.
What are the things you hit on for Gore, for his voice?
A certain calculation. I think his voice carries the same sense that everything, every move is pre-calculated, a certain lack of spontaneity, a certain weirdness in the sibilances, which I don't understand, and then just that trace of Tennessee that I think he calculates to expose at moments when he wants to seem, you know, like one of us.
Had you been working up your McCain when he
Yes, I was. Yes, I was working up my John McCain. I had the good fortune to meet one of his kids, and so I got to see the McCain mouth without and I'm doing this for you physically, so I better find words to describe it, or it doesn't really work on radio, but there's a muscular constriction that he applies to his
mouth muscles, and you only realize it when you see one of his children who has the same mouth, obviously, but unrestrained by that tension. And I don't know whether that's from his days as a prisoner or from his days in the Senate.
You're kind of wrapping your lips around your teeth.
Yes, I'm wrapping them tightly around my teeth. And John McCain does that. And then all of a sudden you see one of his kids and they don't do that. And you go, I get it.
My guest is actor and satirist Harry Shearer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is satirist Harry Shearer. He's in Philadelphia to participate in the Shadow Convention's Rapid Response Team, a panel of satirists, journalists, and pundits who are doing play-by-play commentary on the Republican convention. Arianna Huffington, who used to be very conservative and would be on a lot of political satire shows going up against a comic like Al Franken, mm-hmm. you know, he being
the liberal.
More liberal, she being more conservative. And now she's heading up the Shadow Convention here in Philadelphia and later in L.A., which is standing in counterpoint to both conventions and saying, let's talk about the issues and not just put on a TV spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
But she seems to have undergone something of a political conversion. And I was wondering if you think that's from hanging around with a lot of more liberal comics and satirists.
I do know this. When I hung around with her at the last Republican convention in San Diego, because we'd already become friends somewhat through appearing on Politically Incorrect together, I did say to her, you know, your friend Bill Bennett, I've described as the most dangerous man in America because of his role in advocating mandatory minimums during his reign as drug czar. So the effect of which has been that a lot of violent criminals have had to be freed early to make jail space for the nonviolent pot smokers who are doing 10 hard years, and he doesn't seem to take responsibility for the effects of his actions, even though he believes, if you read the Book of Virtues, or the introduction of the Book of Virtues, he believes in taking responsibility, but he doesn't seem to be doing it in this case. And I was saying, you know, you should read up on this. And now, 4 years later, she is having as one of the major issues not dealt with by either of the two parties at her shadow convention, the abject failure of the drug war. So, you know, I don't want to take credit necessarily, but I think that Arianna is rare in the opinionating business for being somebody who, though she gets paid to have an opinion, is willing to change her mind, is open to reading new information, and is willing to let it penetrate. And I think she gets a lot of flack for that as a result, you know. People are always saying to me, this is a phony conversion, as if somebody can make a lot of money by going left in this country. If left is where she went, I don't know.
I feel like I would be remiss in my responsibilities as a hard-hitting interviewer if I didn't ask you your impressions of hairdos and fashions at the Republican convention.
Well, you know, that's the one thing they haven't been able to change is the amount of hairspray that's used at a Republican convention. They haven't backed off on that at all. One thing that really stood out to all of us last night who were on the panel was the unanimity of choice of the Republican women on the podium. The dress color, the message dress color seemed to be sort of aqua, in the aqua pale green league. That was the color range that everybody chose, Condi Rice and Elizabeth Dole, and I forget a couple of others. But that seemed to be a very distinct message that they were sending. It's a soothing, reassuring color. Nobody wore bright, Nancy Reagan red.
Not even Nancy Reagan.
Not even Nancy Reagan. Nobody wore what I used to think of as, you know, Liddy Doll blue. It was very calm, pastel. I think, you know, the color choice was right along lines with the general soothing, reassuring style and message of the entire convention.
This is an interesting theory. Even Laura Bush, who appeared on video last night, was wearing a pale
That's
green.
Right. That's right. That was the color of the night.
Are you working on your Laura Bush?
Oh, God, it's a little early for that. I haven't even worked on my tipper yet. So the first ladies will take a while. I'll wait till either of them gets elected to really start working on the first ladies, because it takes the campaign for their character and their role in the, you know, the way they're going to be used to start coming front and center. And it's not just the voice, it's the way they're used that, you know, speaks to me about how I want to use them back.
Anything you're noticing yet about either Tipper Gore or Laura Bush?
Tipper seems to be, they seem to be hiding Tipper a lot. You know, she was a lightning rod for controversy a few years back, and I think that they're still a little afraid of using her for fear that that might come to the fore. Laura is obviously being used a lot, and I think she's there to say, you know, whatever the Democrats may say about my husband's youth, I wouldn't have married him if he was still that kind of guy. I think that's the message. Because, you know, you have to feel that she's a down-to-earth, you know, reasonably serious woman. I married a librarian, you know. I think that the underlying message is he couldn't have done whatever you've heard the rumors that he might have heard that he's doing, because I wouldn't have married him if he was that guy.
Harry Shearer, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry, as always.
Satirist Harry Shearer is in Philadelphia to moderate the Shadow Convention's Rapid Response Team, a panel of satirists, journalists, and pundits doing play-by-play commentary on the convention. Fresh Air's executive producer is Genny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Christopher Walken. He likes to say he grew up on the planet show business. We'll talk about how he went from being a song and dance kid to portraying disturbed and menacing characters in such films as The Deer Hunter at Close Range, King of New York, and The Comfort of Strangers. His new film is The Opportunist. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.